Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
And now, back to the man who humbly and graciously accepted the 2002 Small Business Journalist of the Year Award.
Who's the man? Who's the man?
Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate.
We're back. It's 34 after the hour. Thank you very much for staying with us today. If you just tuned in, welcome aboard. My website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com or jbsba.com. And Myron Ebel is with us, ladies and gentlemen, and he oversees all global warming and international environmental work at the the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is an organization that I've been telling you about for a long time. Their president, Fred Smith, and Wayne Cruz is also over there, and Myron is part of that fine organization. And as you know, folks, the global warming debate has been going on now for some time, and it's heating up. The rhetoric is ratcheting up. The pressure is ratcheting up on a lot of people, and we've asked Myron to join us today to sort of help us sort through all this and to help us understand what all this means for our small businesses. Myron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
It's good to have you here, and make sure I'm saying your last name correctly. Is it Ebel?
It's fine.
Okay. Well, I have another friend that's how with your name, and that's how he pronounces it. So
right.
Anyway, okay, here's the question. Is global warming real, or is it junk science?
Well, it depends on what you mean. If you mean, is the climate going to heat up very quickly and all the consequences are going to be bad and we've just got to do something about it, I think it's really, there really isn't a scientific case for that. If you mean the climate's changing all the time, we're in a very mild warming period now and human activities probably contribute something to that, then yeah, it's real. Is it something to worry about? Probably not.
Well, when I'm trying to be my most difficult with my favorite tree huggers, Myron, I remind them that Kentucky used to be under a glacier about 12,000 years ago, and so yes, I agree with him. The world is warming, and I bet the people in Indiana are really happy about that.
Absolutely right. There's, you know, we're in a period now of ice ages that last about 100,000 years, and then interglacial periods, which last 12 to 15,000 years on average. There's a little bit of variety in this for over the last several million years. And, of course, all of human civilization and history has grown up since the last ice age.
Yeah.
And when the next ice age hits, about which we can probably do very little, we have a problem because most of our food comes from the temperate zone, the United States, Canada, Europe, and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And those areas are not going to be habitable. So, that is a huge problem. It's not anything we can do anything about now. I mean, I don't think you can plan for something that's going to happen hundreds of years from now. And we don't know hundreds or thousands. I mean, who knows? I mean, it could start now, but it would still be several hundred years before the glaciers came down.
I mean,
so that's a huge problem. But a little bit of warming, a little bit of variety. For example, in the medieval climate optimum, it's called, or the medieval
right.
warm period, you had wine grapes grown in England. Now, very recently, in the last 20, 30 years, they've started to grow wine grapes again successfully on the south coast of England. That's the first time
right.
since about 1100 A.D.
Wasn't
that
there
they
also,
could do that.
Wasn't there also a warming period, a significant warming period, about 500 years ago?
Well, there's from about from the 12th century on, there was called the Little Ice Age, but there were a couple of very warm periods during the Little Ice Age. But by and large, the Little Ice Age was a problem for people because it meant that there were continuing crop failures in Europe and North
right.
America, and that meant that a lot of people were under very serious pressure over many generations to have enough to eat. And that, so yes, the climate varies a lot, and human beings probably are having something to do with the climate now, but it's something that provides challenges and opportunities and benefits. I mean, there's maybe some bad things that are happening and probably some good things.
When you say human beings are contributing, are you talking about fossil fuel emissions?
Primarily, although I think a very strong case has been made by scientists over the last 5 years or so that land use changes over the course of human history have probably had more to do with climatic change than fossil fuel burning so far.
Talking about forest deforestation, that sort of thing?
Yeah, and your big irrigation projects. I mean, you know, in the Roman Empire, North Africa was really the breadbasket of the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. and now it's just desert.
Right.
Now, a lot of people think there's some natural variability there, but a lot of people also think that human changes in land use contributed to that.
Myron, stand by. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about something called Kyoto. You've heard about it. Do you know what it means? Do you know what it could mean to your small business? 20 Till, stay with us. Here's Joe Cocker. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and Myron Ebel is our guest. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's in charge of their global warming and international environment work there at CEI, and we're talking about this global warming issue. Myron, one of the reasons that you're here today, specifically today, is because as we speak, the president is being soundly beat about the head and shoulders to get the United States to conform with the other countries who have signed on to Kyoto. But before we get into those political issues, tell the audience what the Kyoto Accords are. Take us back to the origins a little bit and bring us forward a little bit, please.
Yes. In 1992, the United States signed a thing called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change under the first President Bush down at the Rio Earth Summit in Brazil. And that was ratified in 1992, and that committed us to stopping dangerous human interference with the climate, whatever that was undefined, but it committed us to it. In 97, in Kyoto, Japan, a treaty was added, the Kyoto Protocol, to the treaty, which committed us, and this was negotiated under President Clinton, and it was really done by Vice President Gore,
right,
which committed us to mandatory reductions in greenhouse gases. Now, greenhouse gases there are several of them. The principal one is water vapor. You can't do anything about that. But it's considered that carbon dioxide from burning coal, oil, and natural gas is contributing to a buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and that that higher carbon dioxide level will eventually lead to a warming average temperature. Now, we get 85% of our energy globally and in the United States from fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. So if you're going to start telling people they've got to use less of it, that means we're going to get a lot poorer. Kyoto committed us to getting 8% below 1990 levels by around 2010.
Right.
And then
our overall national emissions would have to be below those that we had in 1990, even though our economy has grown in those 15 years.
And our population has grown significantly, too.
Right, right.
So what we have is essentially it would require energy rationing, and energy would have to get a lot more expensive. Now, what people fail to recognize is that, oh, well, we can do that. Well, we can do that, except Kyoto is only the first step. People who support it have said we'll need 30 Kyotos.
Yeah.
Now, 30 Kyotos, each one will get more expensive because companies will obviously take the cheapest energy savings first, and then as we go along, suddenly, basically it means the end of the legislated end of the era of abundant energy, mm-hmm. because it means that we will have to stop using coal, oil, and natural gas. We get 50% of our electricity from coal. We get something like 90-some percent of our transportation from petroleum.
What are the chances, Myron, what are the chances that something like this, though, could be the impetus to cause us to create new technologies, new energy sources, find new energy sources, new methods of propulsion? What are the chances that that would happen? That would be the ultimate result of something like of complying with Kyoto.
Well, that's the claim. My own feeling is that government doesn't do a very good job of forcing these kinds of changes, that markets, people who have incentives in markets and markets that are free enough so that people can profit from bringing new technologies and making them succeed in the market. The government basically, in having a cap on emissions, a lot of people have noted that a cap on emissions would probably force improvements in existing technologies, because the cap keeps getting lower over time incrementally at a slow rate. Well, not so slow, but it keeps getting lower over time so that people will try to adapt to it one step at a time. Whereas, in fact, to get new technologies requires a kind of innovation that isn't generally a result of that kind of incremental pressure. Breakthrough technologies take big amounts
of... But you got to admit, though, Myron, research. There's a considerable amount of pressure from the 20th century infrastructure and the industries that are based on 20th century technology. There's an awful lot of pressure on that. I mean, there's a lot of gas stations, but there's not a lot of hydrogen stations.
Right. And I think, you know, there will be at some point an end to the era of fossil fuels, not because we're going to run out of it. The United States has hundreds of years of coal, and the world has a lot of petroleum and a lot of natural gas. I mean, most of the obstacles to increasing the petroleum supply are political, not economic or geological.
And we are less dependent as a percent of gross GDP, of GDP, I should say. We are less dependent on fossil fuels than we were 15 years ago, aren't we?
Yeah, and certainly we're much less dependent on petroleum. Although, obviously, for anybody who drives, we're all very still dependent for our transportation on petroleum.
Right.
But
the economy as
a whole.
Is Mr. Bush? I want to talk about for a moment. We got 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. Is Mr. Bush? What do you think? Will he give in and give some ground in Scotland this week?
I think it's more likely it'll go the other way. I think the other leaders are going to have to give some ground to him. And the reason is
he's a tough guy, isn't he?
Well, he's a tough guy, and the Senate now supports him very strongly, a couple weeks ago, and also they're having problems meeting their Kyoto targets in Europe, Japan, and Canada.
And don't forget, folks, in 98, when Clinton was in the White House and Mr. Gore was an ardent supporter of Kyoto, the Senate voted 98-0 against U.S. joining Kyoto. Tim Till, we'll be right back. When we come back, I'm going to talk about a little bit more with Myron about the Kyoto Accords and what that would mean to you and me. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back at 7-till. I'm Jim Blasingame. The small business advocate, Myron Ebel, is our guest. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's their global warming expert there. Myron, tell us just a little bit about Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Well, we're a small, nonprofit, nonpartisan group that a public policy institute that specializes in regulatory issues from a free market perspective. So we work on environmental regulations, but all kinds of other regulations that affect businesses, from big businesses like antitrust to all of the kinds of small regulations that drive small businessmen crazy.
Well, and our good friend Wayne Cruz, your buddy over there, does his 10,000 commandments every year.
Right.
We've been covering that with Wayne for a number of years, which is the regulatory nightmare that we have to face, and Wayne covers that and reports to us on that. Give us the website, Myron.
It's CEI.org.
Folks, if you'd like to learn more about what Myron and I are talking about, or anything that has to do with public policy and your small business, I think you can find out something about that there at CEI.org. Myron, I just can't hold this back any longer. I've got to get this out of my chest. Folks, here's the problem with Kyoto and the United States signing on to Kyoto. The United States is the most competitive industrialized nation in the world right now. Our economy is growing at almost 4%. Europe is less than half of that. Japan is almost in the tank. China is less than one-fifth the size of the economy of the U.S., but it's growing very well. But that's because that's where the manufacturing is growing. China will not have to comply with the same level of emission standards that the United States will if we sign on to the Kyoto Accords. But Myron, here's the thing that I'm concerned about. Our legal system would allow any country that competes with us to hire a law firm an American law firm in the United States to take us to court, all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary, to make the United States and every company they wanted to target comply 101% to the Kyoto Accords, when the same thing would not happen. The legal system in those other countries would not happen to a level that would put their country at a disadvantage to other countries, but that would happen in this country, and that's what bothers me about Kyoto.
You got that exactly right, Jim. In this country, when we pass a law or sign a treaty, it's enforceable by citizens in court. And this would not only be foreign companies or foreign countries, it would be environmental organizations would go to court and say, you've got to cut energy use, that you've got to, the government has to force people onto an energy rationing diet.
But no disrespect, Myron, no disrespect to Italy or Germany or any countries like that, to their legal system. I don't mean intend to be any disrespect.
Right, right.
But there's no way you can convince me that you or I could go hire a law firm in either one of those countries and convince a judge or a jury to put their country in an uncompetitive situation, and that would happen automatic in this country.
That's right. And in fact, if you look at the countries that have ratified Kyoto and are committed to it, in Europe, the European Union, Japan, and Canada, they're all going to miss their targets. In other words, they've signed a piece of paper, and they're going to miss their targets, and they're going to say, well,
who's
we tried our best.
Who's making them comply now?
Well, there is no compliance.
Because their economies are in the tank. If they complied with Kyoto, they'd be more in the tank.
Well, that's right. But it's funny that they can't even meet their targets even in a very low-growth, stagnant economy have in Europe.
Right.
It shows that there is still a connection between using energy and having economic productivity.
So, Myron, okay, we've got folks out there who are smart people looking around. They're saying, you know, Blasingame, I think we are probably doing something to the economy. I think our emissions are, to the global warming thing. You know, Blasingame, I think it's not junk science. I think that actually we are warming our globe through our own activities. And I'm going to say to them, Myron, okay, I'm with you. But you don't have to sign on to the Kyoto Accords. You don't have to make the United States less competitive to solve this problem. Kyoto may not be junk science, global warming, but Kyoto is junk policy. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right, and I think people need to understand that there's no way that we could solve the problem if there turns out to be a problem in the way that an energy diet would require us to, without really impoverishing the world. It would not only make us poorer, but it would mean that the close to 2 billion people that don't have access to electricity would never get it, because you're not going to get the most expensive electricity to those people. You're going to get the cheapest, and that means coal-fired power plants. Now,
Myron, we got to wrap it up. I know you got more to say, and I'm going to have you back again. We're going to talk about this some more. But you're convinced Mr. Bush is not going to cave this week.
No, and he's got a very strong vote against a sort of Kyoto light McCain bill that Senator John McCain had that backs him up. 60 senators
that.
Voted against it.
Good for that. Good for him and good for those guys. Hey, Myron, thank you for being here. Good job today. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Myron Ebel, ladies and gentlemen, with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Smart guy. We'll have him back again real soon. Got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blasingame. I'll be right back.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.